listen to this, and that's I think he is. You can put a lot of those things like the plate. Mm-hmm. Now it could well be that of the university. This is very difficult to say who to give
credit to
who initiated something. I would be very careful even to claim anything myself, except what I did with my own hand. And I know I did that because looking back, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But I had to do it under pressure. I didn't feel the fun at that time.
No. Yeah.
What do I do? Yeah. It's a pathetic thing.
Yeah.
And I just had to know, let's go. And let's go right in the middle. And I have to, I felt that this is the crux of the problem. And I didn't even talk too much about others, other than just go and do it.
Mm-hmm.
But out of these things, whether that was great, I think I got it from Dr. Field.
Mm-hmm.
The thing with it, with a plate,
yeah,
to work on.
Right.
And we already worked on it for the A4 motor,
mm-hmm,
in Compton.
You know, the smaller chamber size.
And, right.
Yeah.
And, it was on the drawing board to be introduced, to give higher impulse,
mm-hmm,
speak to the manufacturer, and so on.
But you never did it, though, did you?
I don't think it ever was interesting, because there you really would run into serious trouble in the mass production when that put us in entities, and I think it was ready in 44, so there was some way to do these studies. There was no, once you have a mass production and it kind of works and doesn't fall apart, then you can't really change that around.
Were you involved in the throatless chamber concept? Is it just almost like a straight cylinder with a flat injector on the front? This is one of the concepts of the engine theoretically, it supposedly can have higher efficiency. At least some of the curves that I have.
I doubt that. From what I remember.
Obviously, it hasn't been used today, so.
The only way you can prove the higher efficiency is in terms of the mixing again. If you just lose the expansion process, it is not the case.
No.
Because you need a large, low flow velocity in the top compartment. So that's what the thing is. Then you have a boat, the ship is sonic, and then you expand.
Mm-hmm.
And even extending the throat is, unless you have heat transfer, these up from an efficiency viewpoint, and I was running these efficiency calculations.
Mm-hmm.
That, from a theoretical point of view, there's no question. Well, I was running all these kind of calculations. How much did you use in the diversion?
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these calculations were run at that time. And of course, we had come to the bell phase,
mm-hmm,
to prevent some of the loss in these diversions.
Yeah.
You know, there's a cosine loss, and it was just from the on the outside, which you could avoid if you use the bell phase.
Mm-hmm. Who was pushing the problem with the concept?
Well, now, towards the latter, let's say 1944, what were your major efforts in that period? Latter part of 44. You stayed on and seen them when you did the entire war.
Right.
And early 45, when that's when after the BT was operational.
Yes.
What did you do then?
I think we still had the buffer fodder test stand. You see, at that time I had a test stand which, I was a test engineer myself. I was preparing it and starting and running the motor. We had explosions.
Mm-hmm.
And again, with the buffer fodder propellant, we came out with nitric acid. We stabilized it. with I think 10% sucrose acid.
Mm-hmm.
Because the CO would have cut over the food without the sucrose acid.
Mm-hmm.
The efficiency goes down with it. But this was just set by the leadership people that I speak before. Chemistry lab.
Yeah, right.
The kind of thing we just received with the chemistry. And I think we even when the water fire was pretty much the design of this the rocket motor was fixed. I kept on work on the rocket test stand. This was really the experimental test stand. There was another test stand where the more or less production things were tested.
Mm-hmm.
I had
the experimental one.
Number two, I think, was my rocket test stand. And the
we're still on. This is the second part of the interview of Gerhard Heller on the 1st of June 1972. Okay.
There was again with the performance of rockets and used the test stand number two for experimental things. So anything that was introduced in a better plate or in using higher performance. Propellant. That was tried out on my test stand. And for instance, in connection, and that applies to both the A4 and the Wasserfall. We tried out for interest propellant for the A4 that we could use and handle it at all in on this smaller 1.4 ton test stand, which was a different one. I forgot the number. And one of the things we tried out for Wasserfall was a very heavy propellant, which was a methane where the four hydrogens are replaced by in the two groups, tetranitromethane. That was the heaviest fuel you used. So in a given rocket, if you can fill in a fuel that's 50% heavier, you have 50% more mass. And again, that's what increased the efficiency of the buffer part.
Increase the vibration
rate. Vibration, and have larger range, larger maneuverability, and what have you. That was burned. We got this as a, about 5 tons of that material. Now we're burning it on a test stand to number two to see whether can you do that. I had quite some time with the, sound all kind of simple. But just such questions, which propellant, or oxidizer, or fuel you should start with? Or if it should be started simultaneous, how sensitive is that? And I struggled with this one. How to first understand it, and then, so I got
one of the engineers who came over here, Mr. Dobrik, but he left again when he became the chief engineer for a paper plant in Germany, the neighborhood of Stuttgart. And he was a genius in design, designing valves, designing all kinds of things. So I asked him, can you design a valve that can vary the opening characteristics? And I really need two valves. And so I can tweak the I need that valve and the oxidizer, and I need another valve and a fuel. And I want to have these valves variable in their opening characteristics. So I can adjust it so one leaves the other. One cranks up over, I could vary over 10 seconds to open this up. And I experimented with that, and at the beginning we got quite some exposure. Of understanding the problem. So this was a tough one. And this wasn't that sensitive. But again, that injector plate was quite sensitive to, because of the weight front, it was in one plane.
You were damping it out.
And so we finally came to a conclusion that by after some explosion, and we came to the conclusion the best is to move it as slow as you can simultaneously up. Mm-hmm. We have to use valves that can do that, and the valves that have developed and the setting was then tweaked up so we could do this. And I still remember that the first explosion, and it took 2 seconds before the explosion came. And I saw it coming. I knew what was going on, but they rolled along as 2 seconds of my life. I mean, it's really something that you, the attention you relieve. At that time, that motor had about 4.5 tons. You relieve 4.5 tons of power. And actually, the rocket motor was not further away than the wall from here.
Okay.
So if you see that, yeah, it is now going to take off. And explosions are not mild. It was only the fake steel was left. Everything else was gone. And of course, I had 1 meter of concrete in between. I was here, a meter of concrete, and the glass was, it was like, let's say, the opening went out like that, and there were several layers, I think 3 layers of bulletproof glass inserted. And not even the outer glass was busted. It was amazing. So, anyone want the proof that this was bulletproof glass?
Yeah.
I have the proof.
Right.
So after that, I didn't feel so unsafe behind it. But there was no way to other than experiment. We could cross the experiment, but to predict, I knew the problem. I had predicted the problem. And I addressed myself to it, and I learned it the hard way. I had a series of explosions until I understood what it was. Now we do this. They talk about, for instance, shutting off the engine for the Skylab with the 70 milliseconds delay between the outer engine. And I learned that.
You learned that.
That's about the how close you have to get to the fuel signatures. You cannot allow several seconds and have some fume build up, the other comes in.
Burping
and you have, the burping either too. How sensitive is it to the setting of your pressure if that gets too low, the differential pressure? On the other hand, you don't want to have an excess differential pressure that affects your injection here, your pattern. If the pressure is too high and you waste pressure, your pumps have to produce it. And if there's so, I went to the point where you get chugging. I experimented with that to find out where the chugging starts to understand what's going on. And we finally came out with something two atmospheres different is absolutely safe.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, when I came, they had 10 atmospheres differential. And it caused some of the buckling of the wealthy. And there is no need for such a high pressure. Mm-hmm. If you go below two atmospheres, then you build up a pressure here that shuts off the flow, or at least slows it down, and then you get the wavefront dances around, you get the charging effect. That doesn't lead to expulsion, it's just you don't want a motor chuck like that, but it could run for a minute chucking.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you don't completely let one fuel run into the other orifice.
Right.
But normally the chucking starts and is a process like that. So all of these things were going on that test bench, right to 44, and feeding those information into the actual unit, the volume, was like the changing the propellant. You ran it first on the test bench to see whether it won't burn up or heat transfer wise and what have you before it was introduced.
Yeah. Well, then when did you finally give up that technology, as far as you were concerned?
I went with my family, with a train that I think left from Sinewitz. Sinewitz was something like 10 miles away from the inn and the plant, and that's quite a few of the families lived. I lived in Sinewitz. My family was actually in a little village some 30 or 50 miles away because of the bomb danger. Of course, they were brought in. They joined me before that, and then we went with that train to an area in Thuringia. Actually, it was not too far north from where I live in Hesse. It was the Eichsfeld.
Mm-hmm.
Also not too far from the underground
Nordhausen
plant. And we stayed there in villages for a while and really couldn't. We had in mind to set up shops and barracks. They had bought on trucks. Barracks. We had quite a few of those.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about a day to put them on a truck, ship them somewhere. In a day, you could erect those things. They were all easily to be taken apart and assembled again. But
your documents would come down to your equipment, lab stuff. Did you?
That's in this train. There was a lot of that. So it was intended to do some more. We already heard in the night the thunder and the rolling of the front, the Russian artillery, and so people felt it was about time to get a little bit towards the west, and so we were there, I don't know, maybe a week or so, and then an order came to get to Bavaria, and it was already quite a problem which route to take, because they were already between east and west. You had to find a route that still was open, and you had to get orders because everything was clogged up, and it was really amazing that we got those orders.
Who got done for you, I wonder? You got them anyway.
Right. Well, we had to leave a couple of times in the bushes while it was for raid.
Did you go down by truck?
No, with a train.
Oh, same as that.
Well, the train, we had to leave, and then there came an air warning, and then everyone just back there. Man. So we wound up in villages in Bavaria. Not too far from Garmisch Partenkirchen, and
That's where we, in these villages, that's where we were until we arrived in 42.
Did you ever have any contact at all in this period with the SS? Were they ever bothering you? Or?
No, there were, I think they had to sign the orders, otherwise nobody would do anything at all unless you had signed. The guy that saw it and all this was signed by some of those people, and we better do something about it. But no, I never conspicuous through their absence as far as other than that. They had to pay, they had to agree to this, otherwise nothing would happen or in time or order. But I haven't seen anyone of those guys around.
Mm-hmm. You're just in a small town with a few people?
Yeah.
And the American troops came in?
Yes, and it was interesting. It was very close to French troops.
Mm-hmm.
We even had an interesting incident where some of the equipment on trucks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether the trucks will run over the roads or also on trains. My suspicion is that all was loaded on trains.
Mm-hmm.
And they were hidden somewhere in bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the American, our village was occupied by American troops, so that worked out all right. And but some of the electronic equipment was over in the French section.
Mm-hmm.
Was told to the Americans, now, well, we at least, how about getting that equipment? You really couldn't do much under those circumstances in the village, but it would really make sense to get that equipment. And so that the captain went along with his chief and some GIs, and we got this equipment out of the woods, and there was a war. The war was over. We were painted with the army markings or so, and with the camouflage paint. It's the column of German army trucks coming here along. And here was a French patrol. And that patrol leader, the first thing he bang, he didn't shoot at it,
mm-hmm.
I must say, but he shot in the air to stop the column. And what has happened is that this was muddy, this was spray wet. Everything had just thawed out of the snow, and thawed and was real muddy. That captain was riding beside the road, and the road had deep ruts in there. He got stuck with his feet in the rear. And there were kind of tense moments for a while. Nobody knew French well enough to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
Until finally they just kept moving around. So nobody was hurt in the process. And then they didn't want to release that stuff because they said it's an effective. What are you doing?
Yeah, I think so,
yeah. And it was actually, this was the intent to get it out of my perspective.
Mm.
That the intent was clear. Of course, we played completely dumb and waited until the captain was that. American captain, Capitan, what is the place word? Well, we tried to tell you the place, American.
Capitan,
American. And he had the pistol, and we had the. Because he was civilian, there were no soldiers.
Yeah.
They're just civilians, but here came a column of soldiers in the valley truck.
Finally got out, all right?
Oh, yeah.
American talked his way through.
He talked his way through.
Sure.
Yeah,
I mean, he has cleared it with the Sixth Army Command, and so he said, I have orders from General Johnson to think here under the same Sixth Army Command, and I say, if you want to, where are your orders? Because he didn't have them in writing. And I said, well, he can get to the nearest telephone, and we can clarify with the American Army Command. So he had, I mean, he had cleared himself sufficiently that he knew the thing was. You don't do this kind of thing unless you have higher headquarters backing. Because they didn't want to cause a shooting accident.
Yeah,
you can't allow it to.
Well, you know, obviously there was a lot of interest in what you people had been doing. A lot of technical teams came in, and I'm sure that a lot of people asking questions about fuels and injectors and what have you. Could you talk a little bit about how this was handled, the procedures, where you would go, who were some of the people involved in asking questions, and just sort of a little, could you give us a little description of a typical interrogation sequence?
Well, just about? Let me say we were in these little villages there, and some negotiations were carried out, which I haven't been in. Von Braun was not in that little village, but I think Steinhoff and Schilling were. They were some of the senior people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they... they had already a letter which had come from the American command of Army Command, the Sixth Army, and so they already had been contact. And one day it was said we should go on to Thomas Buffett, and it would make an army barracks available to us, which really used to be a hospital, and which had been a German army complex or so, and they said he was moving to that one, and well, why not? I mean, these villagers always said, well, what are these guys here? I mean, they're just kind of the army. Asked them, who are these people? And, well, we're suspicious of them too. So it wasn't really, they were friendly or so, there was no question, but I think we were better off. And so everyone said, they were nice enough. They, in all of those cases, you asked, do you want to go there? Okay, the majority want to go there, so we went into trucks and went in there. And immediately, as soon as we're in, they have the American guards. Nobody could leave again. But that was quite predicted. On the other hand, I think that made a lot of sense in terms of really, we had no business going after.
Mm-hmm.
Things weren't so that you would be too anxious to get around. Well, the interrogation they took them place in this barracks in Darmstadt.
You alone? Did you go in alone to some room with an American, or did it just several of you?
It was a combination, I think. We held meetings where our senior people called everyone together, and they said, we have contact with a colonel from the Ordnance Corps, that's General Taltor.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, so
you
that was the colonel. And
Favor, does that ring a bell?
Favor, yeah. I remember the name.
No.
But wouldn't even recognize him. Yes. And I think Topper came a little bit later. Faber may be the first one who showed up there. And so there was, here the Americans are very much interested in, and they also put it, if I remember right, on a more, on a voluntary basis. And I think these things were handled in a nice way, because that our senior people, when they held a big meeting and everyone was together, and so there was a big debate, and then someone was for, someone was against, and then there were the pros and cons, and it would make a lot of sense to, after all, we are well fed here, and a lot of people around that. Well, all
with the British coming in,
against the guards and so on. And I said, well, the guard, we probably could make a point that we don't need or want the guards. On the other hand, they don't bother us at all. So there were these debates are going on.
Mm-hmm.
So on, and which we kind of liked, because we were to have open debates about issues. Was kind of lacking in Germany prior to that.
So
and so everyone felt that they wanted to speak up, and there was no one else to shut up. We were being told. So that was over.
Mm-hmm.
That was over. Nobody was. You were told, we tell you what to do. That was over. And so they, the way I remember it, yes, there was it was a one by one thing. I put a one interrogator in a room or two. No, I think there was one, and there were even different types.
Were they taking notes or typing?
No, I do not know.
There was a lot of technical detail extracted at that very time and put into very...
There were different types. One was more interested in, the party affiliation and these kind of things. And then there were people interested in the scientific things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of them was tricky and
Mm-hmm.
We had some very interesting discussions with him.
And you met him for the first time?
I think so.
And I guess a lot of people were interested in your experience.
Right, and say, well, they wanted to know. They were interested in the technical things, but also in, well, how it was done. And they even seemed to be kind of delighted that we now wasn't just... If the boss comes and says, we do this, and everyone falls in line. I think they were kind of delighted that there was no intention anymore to do that.
Everybody felt independent for a change, though.
Yeah. And so it was put on, if I remember right, on a voluntary basis, and so we had these discussions. But I must say, other than telling what we have been doing, and I don't remember too much details about those discussions.
Okay.
We've got some of the
Do you have some of that right up?
Discussion of fuels, you know. But it was good. I was interested in the message this was obtained, you know, and we're interested in the competition for the people themselves between, for example, British groups that might come in, Air Force groups, Army groups. And what was your reaction to all this? It seemed like it was quite a period of confusion. And finally, out of this, of course, you went with the Army under contract. But how did this all come about?
Well, I was at Cook's Mountain with the British
for
a while.
Yeah.
But that was after we were in the American camp in Garmisch-Partenkirchen. And that must have been done on the basis of negotiation between the man, the American officer in charge there and the British. And the British said we got quite a number of parts from these two rockets from Nordhausen, which was occupied by the British before they turned it over to the Russians. And before the British already knew it would be turned over, because they must have agreed on something like that. So they got as fast as they could some of the material on trucks been shifted out before the Russians took over. So they had these pots. I say, well, we need some of the Peterman, the people, to launch them with us so that we can learn from them. And I think they must have negotiated that with the American officer there, and there was an agreement for some people. And again, I was asked, do you want to go there? We have been named because it looks like we have you there. They probably went through the list and wanted some aspects, certain people. And, well, we weren't doing anything there, so that sounded kind of interesting. I just said, well, I went there and didn't want to sit in this country forever. And really, we have kind of kept ourselves busy. It was kind of a university going on with lectures giving. I gave some lectures on theoretical non-equilibrium calculations of combustion gas, on the theory of the rocket process. And others on the guidance. I learned a lot during this time.
On
the other thing, so we used the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was daily where they elected.
You gave it in German, the British listened in, or how did it work?
This was just for among ourselves.
Just the German group.
Just among ourselves, internal, but you know, a lot of people didn't really know what I was doing, why this thing
was. It was also secret.
Yeah, internally was the secrecy, but I go after this, and if I do that, I can't talk to the guidance people what they were doing.
Yeah.
I was very much interested in, but I had other things to do.
Yeah.
Now there we had Felicia, and so someone organized this, and I must say I learned a lot from the colleagues about what they were doing. So every one of us. So every one of us gave lectures of this type. But again, this was going on. No, this was in
Gamma.
This was going on for a couple of months, I think, all summer we were there, and then in fall we went to, or late summer, then we went to Cuxhaven, and we went through Eschwege, the trucks. Trucks where the British soldiers, and we were just back from a truck, we went through Eschwege, which is my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the German families had been brought over just before it was turned over, this area of Nordhausen, turned over to the Russians. They brought the family, and they lived in Eschwege.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the people asked them, can we go through Eschwege?
Mm-hmm.
And, my wife lived in Eschwege.
Mm-hmm.
So the trucks went to one part of the town. My wife lived at the least, I would say, 5 miles away from this.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly she thought, I have no way to communicate here. Of course, I talked to some of the British soldiers. They had to drive by there, and she took the bed, which I can understand. I mean, they have a total about half an hour or so on the transit, and or an hour. And my wife heard about it from some of the family, and she heard there is some of the Peenemünde people are there. And I think I've seen a gal out there. I don't know, but he got on a bicycle in a hurry and there she was. Just in the last 5 minutes or so before he had to leave, she showed up. And then in Cuxhaven we worked in the British. There were really two groups. one, the actual launching crew, and then was more or less an engineering crew. That's more or less the desire that was in that group.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't never really running my own rocket engine test, and I never participated in any launching activities. But they had asked for a group like us, who then they could ask if something goes, or these other people could contact, as it was done in Peenemünde too. Mm-hmm. There's always such engineering groups that participate in it, mm-hmm. as we do today, even in the launching. There's our heart tier, where we, anything goes wrong, we have the right guy on hand, mm-hmm. who could say, yeah, well, who knows the design. And we got asked by the British whether we wouldn't want to go to England.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Cooktown.
Cooktown.
And once they had you there, they started making overtures.
Oh, that was later, not right from the beginning. No. Let's say a couple of months, and they came. It was under an. And then an army captain or so, he came the British general. Mm-hmm. No, we've never seen a British general. Well, they told us, the British general. And he wanted to talk to all of us. And one by one.
One by one, yeah.
And we asked him for better food. He didn't like the sauerkraut. He said that for the typical German dish. And I never liked sauerkraut and so on. And one of the things
no
that he didn't come for that, but anyhow, speak that little, these little kind of things in. And what do you want to have? You want to have the same food as the British troops that you got?
What
he really came for is he asked us one by one whether we want to come over to him as a sponsor. He said that we have an sponsor, a military establishment, and we want to take up this, what we've been doing, rocket development. And I don't know whether anyone was taking. There were some people going to. From the Peenemünde group, but I do not know whether any one of the 2,000 group went there. And I had already, it wasn't that simple. There were discussions that before we even left Garmisch-Partenkirchen, that the American Ordnance Corps would be interested. But other than that, there wasn't any firm consideration. So I can't really say made up my mind because I didn't know really whether I should or should not, or whether my family would agree, or whether even there would be such a possibility, and whether there would be an offer and what it be. And on the other hand, I must say, I felt that if we continue rocket free, very likely the logical place would be America.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't, if I remember right, he just didn't believe that the budget would, other than going to America and borrow the money, because really it would be, they're borrowing the money all along for their war effort.
Mm-hmm. No.
That really would go very far, and if I really look back, that's exactly, you have this kind of feeling that I have, and
you
exactly
don't
what happened.
Money. Yeah, those are the very
but the British started really earnestly, monthly, and it came right here, they came to, no, not to public. We were here working on the Redstone. Here came a British commission, and then they wanted to learn from us, and then they started their blue streak.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really much later, and it was never anything comparable to what was done here in America. I mean, they had a program, but I think it was small, and so my feeling was that if I have any chance to go to America, then I'll hold out for that. That's what I told the general. He didn't like it at all.
Did they give you some kind of a deadline to make your mind up and sign for a little pressure?
Who are you to tell me this? Or so don't you consider what situation you are in? Ship us over there, that's one thing. But if you ask us whether you want to or not, you still have a possibility to go to America. And of course, that he just didn't believe in that either. He knows what he has in mind.
Do you remember the name of the British general?
Yeah, that was.
We can find it out.
That would be interesting to get this part of the story.
Let's get that from Crook or Sanders, and then definitely talk. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, there were interesting sidelines in the captain. First, you had a real in the camp. A real, what the Germans call a Kommissknüppel, a super sergeant, but he was a captain, so a real army type. And he tried to bully us around or so. But we were really civilians. We didn't quite know how to respond to military orders or so. He took it for that, and he was just civilians. And he just didn't quite know how to handle a group like that. And we were fully aware of what was going on. We were not overly cooperative. And then they put in a man from had a different caliber. It was I think was a nobleman, was also an army captain, and I think he talked not necessarily more friendly or so, but I think there was more, I think he had a better way of treating a bunch of scientific types like that. And I still remember at one time when the Tory, he was a Tory, understandable as a nobleman, that the Tory government was defeated, and it was for the first time in British history a Labour government. And we asked him about it. When he was discussing how bitterly disappointed it was, and that he himself would not believe after winning the war that this would happen in our country. And so I still was amazed that he was, in his passion, he was discussing with us.
That was Cook. William Cook.
William Cook.
Probably it was, yeah.
Okay, so you can...
I talked to him.
Oh, you talked to him?
Yeah. He's director of the Rolls Royce.
Which
incidentally made the Blue Streak engine from the Redstone design.
And I think he was later, but I don't seen or met him after that. So that if he has been over here with his commission, I don't know. But that would be awfully interesting to meet again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had at least a contact, and he saw in us technical people, and so he didn't try any military type methods, which could still work with civilians. And his approach was he was probably occupation force and so on, but the approach was things like this. I was really amazed that he discussed with us the fact. The political assessment to just in front of us. And
you recall a Lieutenant Hartman, an American, It was at Cuxhaven and sort of the liaison offices from the American side.
Hutton.
It was later at Fort Bliss.
Hutton. Yes, he was. I don't remember that he was Cuxhaven, but I remember him from Fort Bliss.
Yeah, he was also at Cuxhaven.
He was at Cuxhaven.
Yeah, and he was sort of the liaison American military man.
He probably wasn't the one. His very presence meant that Americans hadn't given us up or so. That it was clearly understood we were just on the low to the British.
In fact, he marched that Cuxhaven and Fort back to America.
Oh, that's interesting, because you see, a lot of things we didn't know. This kind of background.
Yeah, this will be in the book.
So, this is probably the reason, because if I remember, how did I dare to tell that British general? I wouldn't, unless I had some kind of assurance that, there's a good chance to come to America. And how did I know? Okay, that's classified.
That might have given you,
There was an American officer in, so you were turned over to the British, and that's the end of it. So you were still considered as being on loan from the Garment Spot Security Group,
American
to the British. I think we were fully aware. I didn't quite know that.
Mm-hmm.
I just wondered myself how come.
Yeah.
Was I that daring at that time or so?
You're looking out for the ornaments.
Yeah. I mean, you had to consider a number of things, a personal interest and what you're doing, and therefore if you have a chance to pursue rocket flights, and we had also ideas, not too openly, about space flight at that time.
You got it much? Do you remember much yourself?
Not much. Sure, I read every report on that subject or so, but no, you couldn't really discuss it. From Brown himself mentioned it once, he got into trouble with the military, so this wasn't but it was there. It lent itself to an advanced process, so we kind of had that subject in mind.
Let's quickly jump across the ocean to Fort Bliss and talk about, again, technical discussions, in this case with industry. Do you recall some of your meetings, say, with North American, engine discussions, vector details?
Right.
Could you describe a little bit how this was handled, and how often would you have these kinds of discussions, who was, and so forth?
This must have been in 46, 47. And I was, it was on a request of North American, and to spend I don't know how many days with us
at North America.
At North America.
Well,
we went out, and I think my first trip really was with an army sergeant that couldn't let us alone, and was to be closed after the war, and so when we even lost, I think this really took me off the record.
And I'm interested in one thing in particular. I guess Regal 3 went to North America and helped develop the Redstone engine.
Right.
And in the meantime, you, I guess, got involved in ramjet engine development in Fort Bliss. And then at some point, a decision was made to use the Navajo engine for the Redstone.
Yes.
But I guess your team wanted to still develop your own engine. There was still some feeling that this should be done on, like, the Arsenal approach or the old Tina Mundi approach.
I don't remember that. I think going to North America in the early times, they were very much interested in starting rocket motor development,
and more or less learn as much about Egypt, the plague, mm-hmm. and I. So I remember that they asked me about all these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they said they would like to duplicate a motor here. What we would recommend was real good technical discussions. I remember mm-hmm. that there was one team after the other. I was in a room mm-hmm. like this, and there was a team of four or five or three, whatever it was, people coming in and asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And different types. Some was more or less the working on vibrations and designer group and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so all day long, or several days, various groups came and asked questions in depth. And I was thinking back, I was well impressed how they had already done some homework. Mm-hmm. They have to feed them in the report.
Mm-hmm.
And they had already started some designs, and they asked them, Furry, why did you do it this way?
Mm-hmm.
They asked the question, would you recommend that we get started on rebuilding this V2 motor, or should we go directly to the ejector plate?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we struggled with that question for quite a while, and I do not know whether I even gave them a very definite recommendation, because that's really their decision. I can mm-hmm. give you all the input or so, but I know they struggled with that, and they came to the conclusion to completely rebuild three engines of this type
mm-hmm.
and here.
From the German drawings, I guess.
And, they had to convert something
mm-hmm.
like that. By
the Air Force sponsored
that. We were in the Air Force sponsored that.
Yeah.
And I must say,
well,
it was an awful good decision. It's still here? Okay, I'll be through in a few minutes. It was an awful good decision. I think I was for it. I told him all the flaws of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
How I was against
yeah,
putting
good.
In a mass effect.
Yeah.
But the thing worked.
Yeah.
If you want something, this other thing has been on a testing, has not put in production, and has not been matured.
Mm-hmm.
This thing, regardless, your welder will have a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing worked.
Mm-hmm.
And we could tell them, and that's what all the kind of things we went through, and what little things can make it fail, because we have to fail. So
right.
I think they try to pump us dry, and I think we cooperated to finally do it, because I was fascinated that really is a group of people who had a whereabouts. I don't think that if people who knew all about rocket pumps or so, I don't think our group had really there with a handful of people. Compared to 12,000 people at Peenemünde, a handful of people find that. Whereas where I went there, those people could put the muscle
mm-hmm.
behind in the building.
Yeah. So you're saying they actually built three V2 engines?
Three V2
exactly
engines and put them in a test stand, and they worked.
They built them.
And I think that's why North American really, for quite some years, had almost a monopoly.
Yeah.
Because they really not quite anymore, but at that time, because they did this.
Mm-hmm.
They ran on there, they built it, they designed it, and they ran it on a test in an engine that worked. And that's the best learning than the engineers who, well, not invented here. Why should I rebuild one of those German things? I know better.
Mm-hmm.
Just to, there's 5 years and a lot of money
mm-hmm.
in this. And so I must give them high credit for mm-hmm. doing it that way. And I think we give them whatever we could, and the Air Force people there, whatever we could because
he was a darn good people who knew how to ask very good questions.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back, that really got his country going. That's North America.
Yep.
You see, an Indian is always the long leap ahead. You want to start a rocket, you can build the frame. Much shorter, and you can build a new engine.
Yeah.
He couldn't have done the Redstone if this hadn't been done. Of course, North American, immediately when they started this, and I remember that we discussed it, I can't remember to what extent I made recommendations or so, to, yes, yeah, the drone. We ran it on the test bed, this ejector plate, to go immediately into that if they rebuilt these, because that's not the thing to put it back. It's just the learning tool. And they did. They considered this as a learning tool, and then they started designing using the German drawings, but there they put in their own thoughts to do better. And that's the energy we use in the Redstone.
Right.
If not for that, we wouldn't have an engine for the Redstone to start with.
Well, was Regal 3 working for them at that time?
Yeah, I think he came. No, when I was there, he wasn't there yet.
Oh.
He probably was one of those interviews. Yeah, I think, not with. I think we were even separate trips.
But who all was going primarily besides you to North America in particular? You recall who else was involved up to?
Regal, I think, was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was very strongly focused. I still think that they wished all these things got them started. They gave years of doing that. Because they learned everything what it takes to design, to build, to test the thing with something that already worked before.
Right.
So if they could, if something wouldn't work. Well, they could go to people and say, well, it didn't work here.
Mm-hmm.
What is the little, why did it work when you did it?
Mm-hmm.
There were people that could ask. So I think they really, that's the way to mm-hmm. not to be on a high horse, I can do better, but to really learn. That's, I think, a key to our success here in this country. To get going on the rocket motor.
But in the meantime, you switched over to ramjets, which was kind of unusual. Here's work with air breathers.
That was more or less given to us.
The two-dimensional ramjet.
Right.
You were directly involved in the injector design on that.
It was given to us. I think
keep you busy, you mean?
Something was not ready even to put a new rocket on the drawing board. You see, the Redstone came in 1950.
No.
And what to do with a group like this without having, General Tolstoy was trying his darndest to get a plastic going or a food.
Keep you active,
And there wasn't any. Other than this thing, this was more or less an air breathing, Air Force kind of thing.
Yeah, so you were doing the Air Force for 5 years. You didn't reduce my such a long
time. Well, we were awfully busy, and I was awfully interested.
No, but I mean, in terms of real advancement, it didn't come until you actually got here.
There was. It took that long in this country to
really
get
it straightened
up.
Right
now, I must say that North American, the lead time was there. We couldn't have started in 1950 if they hadn't already, they had an engine already, and had it tested, and really the Redstone was kind of built around having such an engine.
Sure.
Of course, it had still a lot of bugs at that time, but that 3 years lead time
helped
to get the Redstone going as a puppy.
Yeah. Well, this brings up my next question. You mentioned your test at Kinamundi, running different propellant lead times and so forth. One of the things that made the Redstone different from the V2 is you eventually went directly into mainstay.
Mm-hmm.
Have you run those kind of tests at Kinamundi? Did you already have that technology on the shelf, you might say, that you could say, look, North America, let's just boom right into main stage and solve this instability problem with the flat face injector? Is that a reasonable assumption?
There is one thing where I I knew it at that time from the very things I'd done with the Vatafall.
Yeah.
That you don't fiddle around. We had at least in my concept. Now, still in the production, they might have had that in. This is just the kind of thing that we had done early with the pre-state, the full production. I knew from my tests in this time, 43, 44, that it doesn't make sense. What you do, that what's critical is the timing, not to crank it up slowly with a pre-state, but
the right end of
the right in, but the timing is critical.
Yeah.
If you can hit it properly simultaneously, you got it made. I knew. Now, I don't know why they did it.
But they didn't use that.
Some others here, I had disagreement on it, and they probably sold North American on it.
This is one thing that you could say, well, in each technical group,
there are differences of opinion, and I was on the side of the opinion that because I've done it. But there were other people, other opinion, and they won out, and therefore they lost several years in playing around with this sort of thing. Again, I don't know whether what was then was used there, what that was. I know what I did.
On the waterfall, whether it was fine.
I was on my experimental engine. I had come to the conclusion, do away with all of that if you can do the timing right. Whether on the drawings it was done, I do not know. That's between a. I wasn't in main charge. I was more or less the research group to back it up. Now, whether all what I did really entered in there, there's always a thing. Well, we already decided, and that we can't change anymore. Anything you guys, your scientific type, come up is a change, and we have an order. There is no change there yet. You run against that wall.
And one more interesting observation to me is on the F1, they finally went right back to this to get a stable engine by putting the separation deflectors in the injector.
I knew that this is safe against. I can't run through the calculations in this time when 42, 43 to know under which circumstances an engine is bound to vibrate and under which circumstances not. And that is this year.
It's a very fundamental thing. He's a joke.
You know. All the work's already done.
Well,
okay,
I have it on
already. Okay, thanks for that. Well, certainly appreciate that. Off we go.